Hi, this is Anna Hicks, illustrator of the new limited edition Ear Hustle t-shirt. The following episode of Ear Hustle contains language and depictions of violence that may not be appropriate for all listeners. Discretion is advised.
5, 4. I had seen a movie and they say when you're looking for something, 90% of people never look up, right? And it just so happened there was a tree right there. So I climbed the tree and I hid out in this tree for about an hour while the police were looking for me. I got to the point where I was so cold. There's like a helicopter flying over me. The spotlight is like so shining on me. I'm like, okay, they're gonna see me, they're gonna see me. And they did not see me.
And that is where we're gonna leave Javier for now.
Hanging out in a tree. E, I'm picturing a koala bear. I know a lot of guys in San Quentin have stories about running from the police.
Yep, you skip a court date, maybe you head out of town for a while, cops are trying to track you down. So when you're locked up, you hear a lot of stories about life on the run, especially this cat here.
You know, you have different levels of on the run. You have one dude might have, say he got a dope case, he jumped bail or whatever it is, so he on the run. They not looking for you for real, for real. You see what I'm saying? My on the run, I have 5 different agencies chasing me. You see what I'm saying? I had the bail bondsman insurance, the fugitive task force, Culver City PD, the feds, the marshals. So it was a different kind of run. They were serious.
That's Trevor Woods. He's been on the show before, and he's also Erlon's brother.
Yep, he was on the run for 4 whole years.
I ended up paying $1,000 for a fake license, bought about 10, 12 cell phones, prepaid, gave them to all my family members because I knew the police were on the phones as well. And this is what law enforcement knows sometimes. They know you're not going to cut your family off. You see what I'm saying? They know this.
And you know what I remember hearing about Trevor?
Hey.
When he was on the run, he was still around his family a lot.
Oh, yeah. He's a family dude, you know. Being on the run didn't change that at all.
I didn't cut my family off. I still took my boys everywhere, shopping, everything. I still did everything like I wasn't on the run. You know, when you're dealing with your children, and no matter what a situation it is, those are your children. So I still had duties to do. I still had to get them to school. I still had to pick them up. Took them shopping, haircuts, got them into sports. So I'm a father, not just the word. I was a father.
What was the best day you had on the run? Best moment?
June 26, 1990. I was able to spend this particular day with my girl and my son.
This is Troy Talib Young.
My son was 5 months at that time. He's 30 years old today. Held him, played with him. I forgot I was on the run. I forgot that law enforcement was looking for me. That was the best day.
You remember the exact day?
Yes, the exact day. I haven't had many memorable moments with my son. So the ones I did have, I've always locked the dates in my mind.
I'm Nigel Poor.
And I'm Erlon Woods. This is Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
And on this episode, we're talking about life before prison.
You've committed a crime. The police are looking for you, and you're trying not to get caught.
But the longer you're on the run, the more the people close to you get pulled along too.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of Ear Hustle is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Support for Ear Hustle comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/earhustle. That's odoo.com/earhustle. Odoo, modern management made simple.
What was it like for your family for you to be on the run?
This is Yahya. Until recently, he was one of our producers on The Inside.
If you missed the good news on our last episode, Yahya has been released from San Quentin.
Indeed.
I mean, you were on the run for a serious, violent case.
My siblings were scared because they knew that I had made a vow not to return to prison. I had spoken to my mother while I was on the run. I called her one time. And she told me that LAPD had came by our house several different times looking for me. Well, I was so paranoid and nervous. I stayed on the phone less than a minute. I'm thinking that they got the phone bug and they couldn't trace it if I don't stay on longer than a minute. I told her I was okay, and I told her, don't worry, I'll be all right. That was the only time I spoken to my mother out of 8 months while I was running from the LAPD.
Did anybody in your family try to encourage you to turn yourself in?
Yes, my mother did.
What did she say to you?
She told me that she was worried about me. She was scared that I would die out there in the streets. She convinced me to speak to a reverend named Reverend Brown. He conveyed to me that my mother was worried, and she wanted me to turn myself in so I can stay alive. At that time, I wasn't trying to hear it. I had a belief system. You don't talk to the police. You don't turn yourself in. Whatever happens, allow it to happen.
How'd you get caught?
September 15, 1990, I came back to Los Angeles, went to a relative's home. It was a party. It was an anniversary at my uncle's home. A lot of my family was there. My mother, nieces, nephews, aunties, cousins, my great uncle. Long story short, police knocked on the door. I opened the door, laughed at him, closed the door. My uncle asked me what was going on. I said, the police out there, and I'm not going back to jail. Family looked at me. No one said anything to me but my great uncle. He said, look, nephew, you can't do this, man. Just go ahead and get yourself up. We'll make sure you'll be okay. Took my pistol, which was a .45, out of my pocket. Took my last drink, put the pistol in the trash can, and walked to the front door and allowed LAPD to arrest me.
What made you change your mind in that moment and turn yourself in or allow them to arrest you?
I was in the home, my uncle's home. My mother was there. I was not going to do anything to allow them to be harmed.
Can you describe the first time you saw Javier? First time you laid eyes on him?
The first time I laid eyes on him was in high school. And I told my friends, who's that guy? He he was new. And I'm like, I'm going to get to know that guy. And that guy is going to be my boyfriend.
Wow. What about him, like, attracted you that quickly?
His eyes. I love the color of his eyes and just the way he was different from everyone else. It was like suburbs, and he came from Oakland, so he like stood out.
This is Rochelle, and Javier, the guy she's talking about, he's the guy that was hugging a tree like a koala bear at the top of the show.
Rochelle's in her 40s. She has long brown hair. She's really carefully made up. And Erlan, to be honest, I remember the first time I met her, she was kind of intimidating. I mean, she reminded me of one of those popular girls in school who was not nice to me. But as soon as you start talking to her, I realize that impression is totally wrong. She's super warm and open and really easy to talk to. And describe yourself when you met him. What were you like?
I was quiet. My mother was very strict with us. Mm-hmm. After school, it was like straight home. No friends at home. You do your homework, you do your chores, and that's it.
Was he a bad boy?
Not so much a bad boy, but he knew what he wanted, and he was like the center of attention. Like, everybody would want to be Javier's friend.
So what made you fall in love with him?
The way he treated me. He treated me like I was number one, like, in his world.
I really wanted to talk with Rochelle because stories about being on the run, and no offense to your brother, E, but you know, there's always a bit of swagger in them.
Hey, that's true. I mean, being on the run is movie shit, and in the movies, it's glamorous, being an outlaw, you know, all that shit.
But as we heard with Trevor and Troy, fugitives pull a lot of people along with them. And when a guy goes on the run, there's usually a woman who has her own version of what went down. And it sounds pretty different.
In my senior year, our senior year of high school, I found out I was pregnant.
At first, Rochelle's mom wasn't sure Javier was going to step up, but he did.
He graduated early and came to back to Oakland, found a job, found a house.
About a year after their son was born, the two of them decided to move back to the suburbs where Rochelle grew up. And then what was your life like there?
It was great. It was like the best life I could have imagined.
What made it so great?
The way we were raising our son, the way our marriage was going. My son was in every sport. Javier was a coach for my son's soccer team. We were always the parents that were getting snacks or taking them to, like, get pizza after, like, a game. I was like, I'm living the dream. Mm-hmm. Like, I loved being that mom.
Yeah, yeah.
And our house was, like, the house that every kid wanted to come to. My son was the only one, so he had, you know, games. He had quads. He had dirt bikes. We were full of kids every weekend. And I loved that. I was like, this is like the American dream.
What are some adjectives you would use to describe what Javier was like as a husband and partner?
He was like the man of the house. Like, he took care of everything. I like literally never had to do anything. My money that I made working was like money that I can spend on myself.
Mm-hmm. What were typical gifts that Javier gave you on your birthday or Christmas?
My favorite was like Guess back in the day. Every year I was getting like a Guess watch mm-hmm. of the year. Clothes, cars. For Valentine's Day, I don't know if this is appropriate, but I wanted like implants. Mm-hmm. So for a Valentine's Day, I got what I wanted.
Hey, she got what she wanted.
And Javier, his life was going pretty good too.
I was living a really good life. I worked for BART, which is the Bay Area Rapid Transit here. I was a utility worker there. I had just bought my second home.
Wait, how old are you?
32. Okay. I was in my prime.
In his prime.
E, this guy's got swagger. Did you know Javier in San Quentin?
I have no clue.
How could you miss him? He had like a shaved head, big personality. You know, sort of when he walked into the room, he kind of took up a lot of space. You know what I'm saying?
Nigel, you just described at least 30% of that population.
Oh, you mean like prison bravado? Yeah, I guess you're right. Okay, anyway. Javier and Rochelle had a happy life at home. They've got a lot of stuff. Their son's friends are always over. But that doesn't mean they were homebodies.
Nope. Javier and Rochelle loved to party.
Had this like little crew that always go out on the boat. We had a few jet skis and like 4 or 5 boats deep. So we'd go out all together.
Like where, in the Delta?
In the Delta, yeah. The Delta is like kind of like a party zone, which is where the incident happened.
Nige, that's in your neck of the woods. What's the Delta?
Well, actually, the Delta is about an hour away from San Francisco. And it's this big area of marshes with all these connected waterways. It's super popular for boating. And back when all of this went down, there used to be this bar in the Delta called Lost Isle. And people would come, dock their boats, hang out, and basically just drink beer in the sun. Can you tell us from your perspective what happened that day?
All I remember is us getting to this bar on the Delta. You had to be 21 and over to get on, but we had friends that had her daughter and her friend in a boat.
So everyone was having a good time until a dad of one of the teenage girls heard that some guy was hitting on his daughter.
Of course, Javier's like, what? Who's trying to get with your daughter? These guys walk in, these big, like, Mexican guys with tattoos, and he was like, those guys. And Javier's like, oh, man.
My wife's like, let's just go, let's go, let's go. She kept on, it's, you know, this whole I want to leave thing.
Even people we weren't with, they were like, they look like they're going to cause some trouble.
Respectfully, I tell them, hey, you know, can I help you guys? You guys need something? And they're like, well, nah, you know, we're just here, you know, kicking back. What's the problem or what? I said, well, you know, hey, this is my friend's daughter. I said, she's a good-looking girl, you know, but she's 16. And they were respectful. You know, they said, no, it's cool, don't trip. I said, look, you know, no hard feelings. Let me buy you guys a drink.
For a minute, it looks like things are cool.
Then Javier's friend comes running back from the bathroom. He says he's been jumped.
By those same guys.
The guys come running out. I'm like, hey, what's the problem? I'm Mexican. I look like super white, but they're Mexican too, right? So then I'm like arguing back and forth with them, and the dude's calling me punk ass white boy, and he's like talking all this shit to me. And I tell him, hey, well, what the fuck happened? You know, what's the problem? And he said, oh, you know, fuck you. What you gonna do? He starts throwing up his little hood, and I'm talking shit back. You know, we're exchanging words. You know, nobody's being real nice.
All of a sudden, one of the guys jumps Javier. Javier says at that instant, he sees a knife on the ground, picks it up, and ends up stabbing him.
Then another guy starts messing with Rochelle.
He pushes my wife, so I grab him, and I stuck him 4 times too. Everybody's like, he has a knife. I take off running.
He went one way. They took me another way, and I just remember running to a friend's boat and being put on the boat. And when it finally was like everything was registering, I was like, oh my God, what the fuck happened?
Javier spent that night running from the cops, hiding on the riverbank and up in a tree, like you heard before.
And Rochelle was a mess. Her friends took her to another bar where she did vodka shots until she was blind drunk. And the next morning, she was woken up by pounding at the door. And of course, it was the police.
They were just telling me that Javier killed somebody and somebody else was probably going to die as well. And I remember them showing me pictures of the guy that had passed away. And that, like, freaked me out.
Of him dead?
Yes.
That's what they do.
Whoa. Shake, bleeding, yeah.
when you finally understood what had happened, like, how did you take that information in?
I didn't want to believe it, and I couldn't believe it. I guess I was in denial.
It was 2 weeks before Rochelle saw Javier again. The two of them went to see a lawyer in Oakland. Javier agreed to turn himself in, but then it got tricky.
Javier told us that the guys from the bar, friends of the guys he stabbed, started threatening his family.
They went to the school like 12 deep looking for my son, and their dumb asses like was asking everybody who my son was. They asked teachers and all that shit. They found out where I lived and they went and vandalized my cars. And my family was like totally scared. When that happened, I figured we can't stay here.
Javier's plan was for them all to go to Mexico, where he has some distant relatives, and hide out there for a while.
And Rochelle, she's like, no way.
I wasn't going to pick up our family, my son, and rip him out of the only thing he knew and go to a place that we don't know about, a country that my son doesn't even know the language. So I was like, I'm sorry, but this is as far as I'm going. And whatever you do, you're going to do. I don't want to know where. I don't want to know anything beyond this point.
Were you angry? Were you just in disbelief?
I was numb. I had no emotion. I had no feeling. I was just like in disbelief that this was even happening. Like, I'm going to wake up from this horrible dream.
Yeah.
The night before, he was packing to leave, and we were saying our goodbyes. My son was like, we're not leaving with my dad. I'm like, no, we're not leaving with him. And the look on my son's face, like, got me thinking, am I doing the right thing? Am I going to tear my family apart and not know when we're going to see my husband or my son see his father again? I didn't know.
When we come back from the break, Rochelle makes the biggest decision of her life.
The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black stories, Black truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are the story. Hear a feed from episodes across NPR podcasts that center Black voices. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
I told my husband, like, we're going with you. We're packing. And he was like, what? You guys are coming with me? I'm like, yeah, we're coming.
What were you giving up to do this?
Everything. It was like, I'm going to leave with him and we're not going to be able to have any contact with our family.
Was that clear to you?
I don't really think it was.
Yeah. But, I mean, you're walking away from your mom, your family, his mom, your house, everything you owned.
Everything.
You had, like, what was in your, what did you have with you? Like, what were the physical things that you had with you?
We had photo albums and clothes. That was it.
Oof, E, this is huge. Rochelle was about to walk away from everything.
And we were talking about this earlier, about how being on the run in the movies is always, like, kind of exciting.
Yeah, kind of glamorous even.
But when you hear the choices Rochelle had to make for herself and for her son, all I see is the chaos and the terror of the situation. And there's absolutely nothing sexy about it.
And so you just show up in a car with three suitcases, and then you're just going to start your life over?
Yes.
Like, what did you... I'm sure you're still in shock at this point, and my questions aren't meant to be sound judgmental, but, like, what did you think was going to happen when you got... Like, what did you have any sort of idea in your head of what was going to be the next part of your life?
No. No clue. I was, like, literally living day by day.
Yeah.
They end up in this tiny town where Javier had some distant relatives. And this place was really another world to them.
No stoplights. People were still riding on horses and mules. Yeah, it was like dirt roads.
I'm imagining it's a small town, so everybody knows who people are. Like, weren't people like, who are these people?
Yes. Especially with me me and Javier, we both have tattoos, and they're women, like, having tattoos. I was like a no-no. I have a lot of tattoos, so when I would go out and people would just, like, stare at me, and I even had a lady throw holy water at me.
My wife hated it. There's no Starbucks. There's no nothing. I mean, I had to go, like, to the next town to get a Red Bull. You know, there's, like, nothing there. One main street that goes, like, from one side of the town to the other. One gas station at the beginning of that street and one gas station at the end of that street, and nothing. Me and my wife even walked faster than everybody there. I mean, it was crazy. And then we're all, like, tatted up, right? So we're, like, everybody's looking at my wife as, like, blasted, like, I'm blasted, right? So everybody's, like, they knew who I was.
But did they know you were American?
Yeah.
And they knew you were on the run?
Yep.
Because you just stood out so much?
If people are there, they speak perfect English. You know they grew up in the United States. And they don't ever leave. They're on the run, bro.
I want to say for a good month or two, all I did was cry. Every day. Every single day, I just cried. But I had to snap out of it. And try to make a comfortable life for my son. For me, there was, like, no work. Like, a woman's place was at home, taking care of children and cleaning and cooking. It was my son and myself in this house, and I didn't really leave because I didn't know how to speak Spanish. And he would come home and be like, well, did you go to the store today to, like, buy food? And I'm like, no, I was waiting for you because I don't understand this stupid money, for one. And I'm like, I can't even speak to the people at the store. I had a lot of anger toward Javier. I would throw it in his face, like, I gave up everything for you. I mean, of course, it put a big strain on our marriage.
Yeah.
Ugh, to me, that sounds like death. It's like the worst stereotype of a 1950s housewife. I mean, you're stuck at home, no job, no friends.
Yeah, I get it. She's got nothing.
And sure, things were hard for Javier. But I also get the sense that this was kind of an adventure for him. He didn't have to be stuck at home all day. He got to be out and about in the world, enjoying himself.
Like, there was this one day, he went out to buy some celery.
I go to the store and I tell the lady, I need, you know, how the fuck do you call celery in Spanish? So I'm trying to describe celery to the lady at the store. You know, it's like green, it's like a stick, and it has, like, leaves on it. Es como un palito verde y tiene como hojas arriba. And she's like, she's laughing at me. She's like, ¿cómo que un palito verde con hojas arriba? Pues es como un palito y tiene hojas arriba y se come como en ensaladas y se hace con caldo de pollo. The whole time, you know, I think she pretty much knew what the hell I was talking about. She's just, like, trying to get her fucking laugh at me.
But Javier is also working a lot. They needed money.
it's hard to make a living in Mexico. It's very, very hard, like incredibly hard.
He got a job working construction, but it pays shit and everything is built by hand.
So you're digging trenches to lay foundation. You're doing it with a shovel. You don't got a trencher. You're doing everything by hand. And I worked 6-day work weeks and I was making 900 pesos a week, which is like $75. And you can spend that in one trip to the grocery store.
So Javier needed to figure out a way to bring in some more money.
He'd been sharing food with the guys at his construction site and they loved his cooking. So he got the idea to open a taco stand.
Comida estilo California, right? And everybody's like, what the fuck is California style food, right? Nobody had burritos like I had, and nobody had super nachos, and nobody had these giant quesadillas. I was able to stack some money up and figure, fuck it, my wife can't take it here anymore. I gotta go. You know, I already fucked up our life enough. I want to go somewhere where it's a little bit better.
So they came up with a plan. Javier figured the next closest place where Rochelle might be a little bit happier was Puerto Vallarta, about 4 hours from where they lived.
So you drive in, first thing we see is Starbucks, and my wife is like, oh, hell yeah, I can do this, you know?
When I got there and I seen Walmart, Costco, Carl's Jr., I'm like, I am not leaving. I'm like, this is where we're living. If you like it or not, like, I'll stay here. I felt like so happy again. I felt like alive. That's it. I'm not going back. If you guys want to go back, you guys can go back. I'm staying here. Starbucks bought me.
And what do you have in your hand?
Starbucks.
Do you remember what you ordered the first time?
Yeah, it was a venti raspberry white mocha. Extra hot with an extra shot.
So they decided to pack up and move to Puerto Vallarta for good. Before they left, they told a few people their plans.
And they told me straight up, don't go live there because you're going to get caught. I said, well, fuck it. I'm going to get caught then. I knew I was going to get caught one day.
On the second day they're there, Javier found a bartending job right on the beach. And pretty soon, he is the guy about town. He's recommending restaurants, chatting up the guys at the front desks at hotels, taking tourists to strip clubs, and he's getting a taste of all that action.
Hey, Javier knows how to hustle.
The two of them settled into a life. Rochelle was so much happier, and she got a job, too. It wasn't quite like their life back home, but it was a hell of a lot closer.
It was starting to feel normal again.
Eventually, Javier made enough money that he wanted to open his own place.
And I did. I opened my own bar, a block off the beach, in a nice area. I designed it, you know, I painted it like all this tropical scene, and business took off.
And for about a year, this was a really happy time for them. But then Javier started partying a little too much.
Drinking every single day, not coming home for a day or two, wanting to drink, and party, and black out to where he didn't remember anything. So I kicked him out.
So he pretty much bottomed out.
Correct.
Yeah.
He brought everything down.
Yeah.
The bar, he ran it to the ground.
Yeah, I mean, towards the end, did you recognize anything in him?
No. He was a totally different person. He didn't care about anything. I even, at the end, told him I was leaving, and he basically was like, I don't give a fuck what you do.
Rochelle felt Javier really hadn't dealt with what had happened that night in the Delta, and now it was finally catching up with him.
I think he felt like his past hit him in the face finally. Like, he finally let it all sink in.
It's always in your head. I mean, I damn near every night I would go sit on a beach, watch the sunset fall behind the water, and tell myself, this is probably like maybe might be the last day I get to see the sun, you know, in this environment. And you kind of always live with that knowledge that you're going to get caught one day, you know. And you try to avoid thinking about that, and you try to make a life as best as you can. But the reality is that you pretty much know.
It was really messing his head up.
Yeah.
And he just ended up being a person that I didn't even know and I didn't even want to be around.
Rochelle really thought about leaving Javier and going home. But by now, her son was rooted in Mexico and he didn't want to leave. So she decided to give him one more chance and try to save their marriage.
Then one day, the two of them were out on a stroll.
A van pulls up. Two dudes jump out with AR-15s and a plain clothes guy. And I walk right past him. I don't even think nothing about it. Well, the guy starts talking to me in broken English. Excuse me. I need to talk to you. And I'm like, what? I turn around. Me está hablando a mí? Are you talking to me? He's like, oh, hablas español? I'm like, yeah, hablo español.
The cops asked him where he was from. Javier said, I'm from here. But they kept pressing him for ID.
You fit a description of a shoplifter that has been shoplifting at the store called Liverpool, which is like a Dillard's or a Macy's or something like that, right?
Javier knew he hadn't shoplifted anything.
But he'd been in Mexico for a while, and he thought he could get out of it.
You say, ¿cómo vamos a arreglar esto? How are we going to fix this? And that automatically, they know you're going to pay. So I tell him, how are we going to fix this? He's like, well, are you in trouble or something? Why are you trying to leave? I said, look, man, I ain't got time for this shit.
And were you scared?
Yeah, hell yeah. I was tripping.
What's your wife doing?
Going through my mind, I'm going to run, right? But I got my wife there. And in Mexico, if you run, they shoot your ass.
It turned out the cops knew exactly who he was. They'd been looking for him for weeks. The shoplifting thing, that was just a ploy to get Javier into the van.
Which they did. Eventually, they took him to immigration.
And he does the ink roller on my hand. And when he did that, I'm really thinking, oh, this is a wrap. Running fugitive for murder from the United States. I know U.S. Marshals is looking for me, and U.S. Marshals is definitely hooked up with Interpol. So I'm like, it's over.
We've talked to a bunch of guys who got caught after being on the run for a while. And I mean, you think they would be pissed.
Yeah, but I think it's more complicated than that, Nige. I mean, having to watch your back like that at all times is really exhausting.
For some guys, getting caught, it's like you can finally breathe. Like Troy, who we heard from at the top of the show.
And so how did it feel to get put in handcuffs?
Actually, I was relieved because I was tired of running. There was no joy to it. I was tired of eating fast foods. I was tired of looking over my shoulder. I was out of control.
E, did your brother feel that way?
Hell no. But I did. You know, every time I saw something on the news that said fugitive killed, my heart stopped for a second. You know, I was worried it was my brother they were talking about. So when he got captured, it kind of brought some peace to my heart because he didn't get killed out there in the streets.
Mm. Was there any part of you that was relieved that he got caught?
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
I don't know if it was like being a coward, but I didn't have to be the one to leave.
I keep going back to how much you gave up for him and how difficult it was. And so I wonder if there was any part of you like was, fuck yeah, he finally got it. Is that a nice thing to think? And it's not nice for me to say it, but I just wonder, it's like you really went through so much.
Yes, I did. And yeah, it was, because like I said, our marriage was already strained to where I'm like, thank fucking God. I couldn't do it anymore.
And what did you think you were coming home to?
To nothing. I didn't even know where I was coming home to.
6 years before, they'd left the U.S. with pretty much just whatever they could carry. Now, they were leaving Mexico the same way.
With another 3 suitcases of our belongings. Left our house furnished with everything, TVs and clothes that we couldn't bring back, and started all over again.
Javier and Rochelle came back to the States. Javier went straight to prison, charged with manslaughter and sentenced to 9 years. He eventually landed at San Quentin State Prison.
Rochelle, she was already standing by her guy for 6 years before he even went to prison. If it were me, you know what I'd be thinking?
Yep, you be thinking, it's my turn.
Exactly.
I needed to find myself. I didn't want to have any contact with him. I didn't want him to call me. If he was going to write me letters, I wasn't going to write back.
Do you know what I feel like should happen here?
Hmm.
What would happen if this was the movie version? So Rochelle would finally get her time, be able to focus on herself. Javier serves his time in prison. Then he gets out. The two of them fall in love all over again, and they start on the next phase of their life.
Right. As equals.
Exactly.
But something else happened. They both got really sick.
Almost as soon as Javier came back to the States, he was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. And at almost the exact same time, Rochelle finds out she's really sick too, with another type of cancer that's been spreading quickly.
So there is really no time for me to find myself.
So, I mean, taking care of this is a huge part of your life.
Yes.
I'm guessing.
It's taken over.
Yeah.
I haven't fully gotten my life back, but I'm happy.
Mm-hmm.
I can finally say I'm happy now.
And what makes you happy now?
Having grandkids.
Oh, that's what's up.
Yeah, a 2-year-old grandson and a 3-month-old granddaughter. They keep me going. And if I am having a bad day, I can just, them going crazy at home makes me happy. It's not about all the toys and money and, I mean, all that is nice, but I don't want that anymore. I am happy with where I live. I still love, like, my clothes. I still love pampering myself, but I don't like all the extras anymore, and I don't care about the extras anymore.
And so what's going to happen in a month?
Javier will be getting out.
Javier spent about 7 years in prison.
But when he gets out, he can't move in with Rochelle.
That's because one of the conditions of his parole is that he has to spend 18 months in the county where he was living before he fled. And that's a couple of hours away from where Rochelle lives.
So once Javier's out, is there still work that you need to do on your marriage?
Oh, definitely. Not so much that it's a strain or anger, that's all gone, but now how is he going to fit in our lives, on our lifestyle? Because the lifestyle we had before, we don't have anymore. And that's a lifestyle that I never want anymore.
E, when you and I left that interview, here's what I wanted to know. I wanted to know, when those 18 months are over, is Rochelle going to let Javier come live with her again?
Rochelle is real sick, and it's Javier's turn to stand by her side.
Well, we have an update. I spoke with Rochelle a little while ago. Rochelle, it's beautiful to hear your voice. I really appreciate you doing this.
No problem.
E, I got to say, I was a little nervous to call her because I just didn't want to bother her.
Yeah, I can hear it in your voice.
Yeah.
She told us her cancer has taken a turn for the worse. She'd been in the hospital for the past week.
I was rushed to UCSF, and I've been here ever since. You know, I'm the one that's telling everybody it's going to be okay. And deep down inside, I'm like, it's not going to be okay, and who am I going to be able to tell? Like, you know, I'm drowning at the same time, but yep. I need to be strong for everyone.
Rochelle told me that the morning she got really sick, Javier had called to see how she was doing, and she told him that their son was taking her to the hospital.
Javier raced over, and he drove her the rest of the way to San Francisco, and the whole way there, he kept talking to her.
it's going to be okay. You're going to be fine. You're going to get through this. I'm here for you. Do you want me to lean the car seat back? Do you want me to lean it forward? Do you want me to rub your back? He was really there in my time of need.
I got the sense that for the first time in a long time, Rochelle was feeling taken care of.
Finally, I let my guard down and I'm like, I'm not okay. I don't want to die, you know. And he's like, you're not dying. You're not going anywhere. We have a lot to see and do with our grandbabies. Just relax and breathe.
When you guys were on the run and when you were in Mexico, he needed you for support for everything. And now it seems like the tables have turned a little bit. Does it feel that way at all?
Yes. It's not so much about him anymore. Like I said, he had got lost in himself when he was trying to figure himself out. And it's not about him anymore. It's about what he can do to make us happy, what he can do to fill that void that when he was gone.
So when the time comes and he can move in, are you ready to welcome him into your home again?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. He's also melted my heart all over again with seeing him with our grandkids. My grandkids are my everything. And seeing him interact with our grandkids, it just really, really touched my heart.
Rochelle, we're thinking about you.
Definitely.
Ear Hustle is produced by Nigel Poor, Erlon Woods, Rasan New York Thomas, John Yaya Johnson, and Bruce Wallace. This episode was scored with music by Antoine Williams, Rashid Zinneman, and David Jassy. It was sound designed and engineered by Antoine Williams. Amy Standen edits the show. Aaron Wade is the digital producer, and Julie Shapiro is executive producer for Radiotopia. Ear Hustle would like to thank acting warden Ron Broomfield. And as you know, every episode of Ear Hustle has to be approved by this guy here.
This Lieutenant Sam Robinson, the public information officer at San Quentin State Prison. This was actually one of my most enjoyable episodes. Javier worked in the media center as a staff photographer of the San Quentin News. And I remember interviewing that guy. And I don't want to call it bravado or I don't even know what the right word is to call my initial engagement with my initial interaction with him. But I remember hiring the guy and everything that you heard in this episode with his personality and his drive, and it comes across that there are some people who are destined to kind of have success at whatever they do, and I think that's what you got from Javier. So with that, I will say that I approve this episode.
This podcast was made possible with support from the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, working to redesign the justice system by building power and opportunity for communities impacted by incarceration.
This podcast also received support from Woven Teaching. Woven Teaching is a recently launched educational nonprofit providing lesson plans, discussion guides, and primary source materials for teaching about genocide and human rights. Woven Teaching, practical help for teaching ethically and effectively. To learn more, please visit woventeaching.org.
Ear Hustle is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a collection of the best podcasts around. Hear more at radiotopia.fm. I'm Erlon Woods.
And I'm Nigel Poor. Thanks for listening.
Indeed.
Radiotopia. From PRX.